This is Tuğrul Keskin from Portland State University International Studies. This is the last session, last panel. We are going to have Deepak Kumar, Asad Abu Halil, Joel Benin, and Wael. They are going to talk about, you know, these challenges in prospects in Arab Spring. And we're going to have 10 to 12 minutes. We don't have a time for the question and answer session. And Deepak.
Okay. I want to thank the organizers for inviting me, and especially Hannah McCain for being so organized and incredible. I was one of those holdouts. I kept insisting that I couldn't come all the way from the East Coast because it was just so tiring and so forth. But I'm really glad that I'm here today, and I've learned so much from this conference. So a big round of applause to everyone who helped put this together. Okay, so 2001 really marked the beginning of an era of revolt, in fact, global revolt, against neoliberalism and against dictatorships. And it was really inspiring to see, in a matter of weeks, two U.S.-backed dictators in Tunisia and in Egypt being toppled by people's movements. And in an earlier session, Joel talked about the role that the working classes actually played. They played a decisive role both in Tunisia as well as Egypt. And of course, part of what happens after this is not only that the inspiration gets spread to movements in Bahrain, Yemen, Libya, and so on, but also to Madison, to where people are standing in solidarity with the Egyptians. There are picket signs that read, "Fight like an Egyptian," Hosni Walker, comparing Scott Walker with Hosni Mubarak, and so on. And of course, Greece and Spain, and finally the Occupy movement. Now, in the time that I have, which is not a lot, I want to take up one particular question, and that is that even though these uprisings have been so inspirational, what we've seen is that in the political vacuum that's been created, the Islamists have actually come to power, whether we're talking about the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt or Ennahda in Tunisia. And of course, some commentators have said, what else do you expect? People in Muslim-majority countries, if they get a chance to vote, they're going to vote in the Islamists. And I want to actually push back against this logic and sort of lay out very quickly a historical perspective for why it is that the Islamists have actually been able to capitalize on the political vacuum that has been created in the aftermath of the toppling of dictators. I think the first thing to be said about this question, and this is a mythology that's peddled by Orientalists like Bernard Lewis and Samuel Huntington and so on, is that there's never been a separation of religion and politics in Muslim-majority countries, and I think that's absolutely wrong. If you look at the long historical picture, at least for a millennium, there's been a de facto separation, if you will, between the people who run and have control over the personal and the religious sphere versus those who had control over the political sphere. And so the way some scholars talk about it is there was a division of labor between the men of pen and the men of sword, where the caliphs and the ulama and so on controlled personal life and controlled religion, whereas the emirs and the sultans and so on controlled the political sphere. And of course, this was necessary because as Islam spread and as the Muslim empire spread, not from from Arabia across to all the way to India, to North Africa and to Spain and so on, it was necessary to have this sort of division of labor. And then, of course, more recently, about two centuries ago, we've seen the introduction of modernist capitalist reforms in Turkey, in Egypt, and so on, which sees the birth of a secular middle class in many ways that actually takes over the functions that the ulema, the religious scholars, used to have earlier. And this is why, in the context of the colonization of the Middle East and North Africa and so on, for the most part, the struggle was really led by secular nationalists. And secular nationalism, as such, was one of the key ideas that vied for political hegemony in the political sphere. Now, the question is, at what moment then do the Islamists actually begin to start to replace, if you will, the hegemony that secular nationalists have? And that's really a phenomenon that only happens in the last three decades of the 20th century. And we have to be able to explain why. Well, first and foremost, there is the role that the West, and particularly the U.S., played in the Middle East and North Africa and elsewhere in terms of bolstering and propping up the parties of political Islam. Keep in mind that this is the post-Cold War period, and for the United States that initially tried to co-opt the secular nationalists, particularly people like Nasser and Mohammad Mossadegh in Iran, and saw that they actually couldn't, it was necessary to formulate what they called an Islam strategy. And in fact, you see this in the Eisenhower Doctrine. It's not something that's very well known, but part of the thinking in the policy circles was to create what they called an Islamic Pope. They wanted the Saudi king to actually act as a pole of attraction away from the secular nationalist leader of Egypt, Gamal Abdel Nasser. And of course, in addition to using Saudi Arabia to try to Islamize politics in the region, we also see that alliances are formed with the Muslim Brotherhood. Just by way of example, the Muslim Brotherhood of Egypt, that is. Just by way of example, Saeed Ramadan, who is Hassan al-Banna's son, the founder of the Muslim Brotherhood, is invited to the United States in the 1950s. He's a participant in at the Princeton Conference where these strategies are being formulated. He gets to meet with, I believe it was Eisenhower, and talk to them and so on and so forth. So there's been a long history of relationship between Islamist organizations and the United States. And of course, the most famous one that everyone knows is funding for the Mujahideen in Afghanistan, where the U.S., you know, funneled billions of dollars to train, arm these folks. So that's one part of the puzzle, which is that these forces get credibility and legitimacy not only through U.S. support, but also through Saudi money and now Qatari money. Now, the second thing is, of course, you know, the U.S. also militated against secular nationalist leaders and tried to, you know, get rid of them, and also against the left, whether this was assassinations and what have you, like in Iraq and elsewhere. There are some comical stories, actually, at attempted assassinations of Nasser. They poison his cigarettes at one point. The CIA tries to, another point, they try to poison his chocolates, et cetera, et cetera. But regardless of external efforts, there were also internal weaknesses in secular nationalism. While there was a period where secular nationalist leaders, and particularly Nasser, was able to deliver on some promises of economic reform and upliftment and so on, by the time we come to the late 60s and 70s, these methods, these state capitalist methods, are quite, you know, are running up against the limits of what is possible. And then in the aftermath of the defeat in the 1967 war, the Six-Day War with Israel, both politically and economically, secular nationalism as an ideology begins to come into question. And this is the context in which the Islamists, backed by Saudi money, are able to vie for influence on campuses, particularly in Egypt, but then that would start to spread all over. Now, the vacuum created by the collapse of secular nationalists could have been filled by the left, the communist parties, various left parties, and so on. But the problem is they made a bunch of mistakes, and they were Stalinized. I don't have time to explain all of that, but suffice it to say that their goals and orientation were less about what people in various countries needed and wanted, and more in line with what the Soviet Union wanted. And so by the time we come into the 50s and 60s, we have a situation where they are tailing the secular nationalists so much that when secular nationalism as an ideology goes into crisis, so does the left. And in this gap, the Islamists, of course, start to vie for power, for influence, starting from the 1970s onwards. And so coming to the present, we now have a situation. I don't know that much about Tunisia. Others can talk about it. Assad talked about how there's a bigger left in Tunisia than there is in Egypt, and people can talk to it. But I want to just speak very quickly about what it is that explains why the Muslim Brotherhood was able to win elections in recently. And first of all, you know, it is the key opposition party. That is to say, even though it was persecuted by the Mubarak regime, it was also allowed to exist. And it has, you know, some of the deepest roots and the machinery, political machinery, to be able to capitalize on this context. But the question then is, why did people actually vote for them? Why did people in the movement actually vote for them? And there's no denying the fact that some people voted for them because they support their ideology and their philosophy and so on. But some of the activists on the ground have written about how other sections of the movement that actually toppled Mubarak voted for the Muslim Brotherhood for a couple of reasons. One, because from time to time they have actually critiqued the excesses of neoliberalism. They have charitable networks that actually give real, you know, funding and sustenance to what is it, 40-50% of people who live below the poverty line. And they also have credibility because they've been persecuted by the state, and there's a sense in which these are honest people, let's give them a chance. But the fact of the matter is, at least in the English press, the business elite who are associated with the Muslim Brotherhood have come out in no uncertain terms to declare their pro-neoliberal politics. And furthermore, as we've seen, the Muslim Brotherhood has been more than willing to be the political face of the military, and they're even actually in negotiations and discussions with the NDP, that is Mubarak's political party. So, okay. And so, for me, these uprisings really mark the beginning of a long process. And I think people will learn through the course of struggle where to go and how to organize and how to actually have their political aspirations and their economic aspirations be realized. I mean, early in the Egyptian uprising, there was a sense in which, you know, one of the slogans is the people and the army are one. Now it's obvious that the people and the army are not one. So in some ways, people have to learn through actually going through the process. And I think the bankruptcy of the Muslim Brotherhood and their inability to actually meet the needs and desires of the people will become apparent in the years to come. And I think it's from that that a new left can actually begin to start to grow and begin to start to offer a progressive alternative. And I'm going to argue that the Independent Federation of Egyptian Workers Unions, which is somewhat affiliated with the Workers Democratic Party. The Workers Democratic Party, of course, is formed by a bunch of left-wing organizations, but there are some roots within the working class, and that has to deepen, and that has to grow. And it is from these sorts of efforts that a left politics, a secular left politics, independent of the mainstream parties, can be formed. And it's from there, I think, that the hope, the aspirations, and the reasons why people stood up in the spring of 2011, it's from there that those can be realized. So I'll just stop there.
Thank you to Dr. Kumar. We have a second speaker, Dr. Asad Abu Halil.
Ten minutes.
You probably stand.
Well, I mean, I think that I only have time to make very few points. Some of you heard me earlier about my views on the so-called Arab Spring. The first point I want to make, even though Nora did a very good job about speaking about the recent Palestinian uprising, is the extent to which the Palestinian struggle over the decades has been the real inspiration for the Arab uprising. I give credit to the Tunisian president, even though I have not been pleased with his positions ever since he ran for president and made alliances with the Nahda in Tunisia. But he was recently in Libya and was asked in an interview with a Libyan newspaper how he feels, because the perception in the Arab world is that Tunisia inspired the entire Arab world with these uprisings. And he modestly conceded that the real inspiration came not from Tunisia, but from the Palestinian people. I think the first example of the uprisings of which we speak today is the 1936-1939 uprising. And many of the lessons from that revolt or uprising, by the way, there's a very interesting, good study that is done on that by Ghassan Kanafani, which is translated by students from Rutgers University and put online. And basically, I mean, there are two phases of that uprising. And the first phase, until from 1936 until 1937, and there was so much pressure put by Saudi Arabia and by Arab governments, clients of the British at the time, for the Palestinians to suspend their uprising in order to give a chance to the British to give an acceptable solution to the Palestinians. As it turned out, of course, the Palestinians were cheated. And then the second phase of the uprising was marred by divisions, internecine wars between the various Palestinians, and factions that were on the payroll of Zionists, we now know, like the Nashashibis, did a very good job in diverting Palestinian hostility to Zionism into a kind of Palestinian civil war, by the way, something we've seen in the Hamas-Fatah struggle over conflict over the last few years. The lessons from that important uprising, which I think could have had tremendous impact on the early efforts by Zionists to establish a foothold in Palestine, can be applied today. And I will go from that to speak about certain challenges facing the Arab uprisings. Number one, I think is a large attempt by the United States to coordinate counter-revolutions at the regional level and in every country. In every country now, the United States is working closely with a faction or party that answers to it and to Saudi Arabia and or Qatar, and basically that attempts to prevent the people from pressing ahead with a radical agenda that has been embedded in all the uprisings as they started. So the first challenge is how to meet Arab counter-revolutions wherever they are, from Yemen elsewhere. Second point is that the extent to which, and this is true, of course, the Palestinian revolt of 1936, the extent to which there is an attempt to moderate the agenda and the demands of the uprising. I mean, in Yemen, it went from, I mean, the Arabs who protested were very clear. The slogan that has been chanted from North Africa into Bahrain is the same. I mean, that's a testimony to the fact that the Arabs are not as divided as we have been led to believe by people who have been reading eulogies of Arab nationalism over the decades. And the slogan says, "Ash-Sha'ab yurid isqat al-Nizam." The people want the downfall of the regime. I mean, the slogan is very uncompromising. It leaves no room for half measures. It leaves no room for amnesty for the dictator. And yet, notice, from Tunisia to Egypt to Yemen, Bahrain, of course, is too blatant. There is an attempt to make the people moderate their demands and to make them much minimal. And this is part of the third challenge, which is people have been wanting to overthrow regimes. Are we going to allow for the replacement of the dictator, either with his successor or with a successor that is handpicked by the Americans? I think the real test is going to be in Egypt. It's going to be in, Yemen, obviously, early on. And in other cases in the Gulf countries, I mean, there's not going to be any change. The fourth challenge is the extent to which the Gulf Cooperation Council, a group of tyrannical, traditional, tribal, medieval-style leadership, are going to monopolize representation of the Arab people. I mean, there is a certain irony. Those are the opponents of democracy, are now invited to international fora to speak on behalf of the Arab youth. I mean, to witness Hamad bin Jassim, of all people, being asked to represent the aspiration of the Arab people is rather, for a lot of Arabs, most of them, rather comical. While these countries are very clear that they will not allow any of their countries to become democratic. And this is part of the bargain that basically erased for a while the feud, the famous, bitter, bloody feud between Saudi Arabia and Qatar. A year and a half ago, I was in Qatar for Al Jazeera show. The Emir of Qatar invited me to meet with him. So I spoke with him for like 2 or 3 hours. And one of the things, so he was telling about reform in Qatar and so on. So I told him, can I form a political party in Qatar? He said, no. I said, can I form a committee against normalization with Israel? He said, no. I said, so your reform are totally non-political? He said, yeah. And I asked, why is that? So what happened in Bahrain, I remember that conversation when I witnessed what happened in Bahrain. He told me, in the Gulf Cooperation Council, we cannot allow political development to be ahead in one country of another country. So I told him, basically, so there is an agreement on dictatorship among all of you. He was like, yeah, we cannot change how we are. It's going to be exactly the same. And I think that is not entirely domestic. This is a service done to their dynasties. In Bahrain, they have been there for 200 years. They steal the land and they make money of it in Bahrain. Basically, it's a deal that is representing American interests. The United States deals much better, especially in military terms, with these kind of dictatorships. The challenge is to allow that to continue. Number five is the challenge of the media and popular culture. Saudi Arabia and Qatar, I mean, I mentioned earlier, we have more than 700, satellite TV stations in the Arab world. More than 80% of them, maybe 90% of them, are owned by Saudi royal family and their business or relative affiliates. Some are for Qatar, I mean, the rest of them are for like billionaires in Egypt and Lebanon and places like that. I mean, these are the people who run the popular culture. The challenge is how to penetrate through the media. I mean, in Egypt, it hasn't been easy. There were early attempts. They have been all stifled by the business elite. Al-Masri Al-Yawm early on started as an independent newspaper under Mubarak. It landed in the laps of a billionaire. The same thing with Shuruq. So there is a real challenge in trying to break through the monopoly of the media and popular culture, especially that the United States wants to work closely with these kind of media in order to stifle advocacy for the Palestinian people. The sixth element of the challenge, I think, is this. I believe that political struggle against the regime, and Egypt is always the best example of what's going on in the Arab world, is going to prove that the political struggle cannot be, I mean, I know this sounds like typical leftist, cannot be separated from the struggle for social justice. I mean, if you look, if you can do a class analysis of the Mubarak regime, and you will find that the political elite of Mubarak was, this is like the C. Wright Mills power elite all over again applied in the Arab world. You have the political elite of Mubarak tied to the business elite. These were the partners in crime, and they have not been punished. There was one or two taken as representative token to be made as token examples, but it hasn't gone through to punish them. And the third element are the normalizers with Israel. I mean, one of the most corrupt Egyptian businessmen and the ones who has been giving mansions and villas to the Mubarak family. I mean, he was living in Sharm el-Sheikh in one of those villas donated by Hussein Salem. That guy is the same guy who, clearly with American support, had the gas pipeline deal with Israel, which was an insult to the sentiments of the Egyptian, not to mention against the economic interests of the Egyptian, because it was selling gas at such reduced prices to the Israelis. And, of course, the Egyptian people have made their feelings about the gas pipelines very clear, thus far 12 times clear. But we'll hear more about them, I think, in due time. So I think the campaign of social justice is clearly going to be necessary to bring down the social roots and bases of these regimes. In this way, I think this partly is leftist optimism. The Muslim Brotherhood has nothing to offer in that regard. In Tunisia, as you know, when Ennahda first won the election, before they even like sat in parliament, they said they would like to keep the Minister of Finance and the Governor of the Central Bank. I mean, before they even sat in parliament. And they were clearly sending a message to Washington, D.C., of course, and the message was well received, but not by the Tunisian people. The Tunisian people pressed ahead, and this became a very controversial issue. And I think the same thing I expect will happen in the case of Egypt. So let me conclude by saying, I mean, it is a process. I mean, I do not declare it a revolution, as I said earlier. The verdict cannot be declared yet. But certainly we are part of a process. It could lead to a revolution, provided the radical agenda is not compromised, and provided that people in the Arab world are not victim of an attempt by the Americans and the Saudis and the Qataris to convince them, like the Mossad has done with the Arabs all these decades, that they are not capable of changing their destiny, that there is a power out there that is so big, that is so invincible, that it cannot be defied. I mean, Israel has done that to the Arabs until 2006. And I think this is why the Americans, on purpose, disguise their surprise at the Arab Spring and may be beneficiaries of the propaganda of the Syrian regime to the effect that Arab uprisings are all part of an American conspiracy or machination. I think the Americans would like that kind of thinking to prevail, because then the Arabs will go back to the era of despair and of helplessness. And that would definitely kill what began as a promising, potentially revolutionary process. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Rabbi Hillel. And third speaker, Dr. Benin, Joel Benin.
So I'm going to stand because my voice is weak. And because I'm a historian, I'm going to begin a little further back. Between 1967 and 1973, two things happened which didn't look like they were connected, but which became connected in the Arab uprisings of 2011. On the one hand, the expansion of global capitalism from the end of World War II, during which Europe was rebuilt, standard of living increased steadily in the United States, and generally speaking, capitalism seemed to be working fine, ended. And it ended because of the cost of the Vietnam War and the effort to try to keep expanding social programs in the United States. Since that period, the global capitalist system which the United States leads has been in constant crisis. There was the high-tech crash of 2000. There was the financial crash of 2008. There was the 10 years of stagflation between the late 1970s and the late 1980s. Little mini-crises or bigger crises fixes. The main fix that has been tried since the Reagan-Thatcher era is neoliberalism, a hardline vulture capitalist system with no social safety net and so on, but it hasn't worked. We are still in a system which is in crisis, not only locally but globally. In the Middle East, 1967 marked a crisis for radical Arab nationalism, Nasserism, Ba'athism, Arab socialism. Not that it was the end of the feelings that Arabs had that they are more than just Tunisians or Egyptians or what have you, but the economic project of Arab socialism was shown to be a failure in confronting the most important enemy that it faced, which was the State of Israel. And these two things have coexisted in the Middle East for quite a while. The United States trying to rebuild the Arab world in the framework of neoliberalism, beginning in 1974 with Egypt, Anwar Sadat's open door policy, Tunisia, Morocco, Jordan, also very strong in this regard. Even Algeria did it to itself first before the IMF did it. So there was an effort to suck in the Arab world to this new neoliberal global capitalist model as part of the effort to resolve what was America's economic problem, but also that could be possible because of the failure of the Arab socialist economic model. Therefore, when the uprisings came, there was a sharp debate over what they meant. The slogan, "the people want the end of the regime," is clear in its politics. It isn't so clear in its economics. But there were slogans that were raised which were economically clear. In Egypt, first, bread, freedom, social justice. Not what is social justice exactly, it's not so clear, but they are speaking about the plutocracy that ran the country and made out like bandits for decades. And you had almost immediately the effort in the United States and other Western countries, especially France, to play with these two things. Oh, okay, we realize it was a mistake. We shouldn't have backed the dictators, Mubarak and Ben Ali and all of them. So democracy. And who is the force for democracy? Facebook revolution. All these high-tech people who are actually like us. I mean, they speak English, they use Facebook, they use Twitter, they're internet savvy, they're educated in places like the American University in Cairo. So really, it's cool. They're like us, and we can absorb them. And so they get to be on the cover of Time magazine, Wael Ghanem and his friends. And so even in Palestine, Fadi Quran, who's a graduate of Stanford 2010 and who was actually beat up and arrested on Friday in Khalil Hebron, was also featured in Time magazine as one of these faces. So the Western powers, United States primarily, France secondarily, have a way to try to seize hold of this upheaval and contain it. On the other hand, the demand for social justice has not gone away. And you can see this struggle internal to the revolutions. So Ahmed Maher, who was one of the founders of the April 6th youth movement in Egypt, one of the forces that called for the demonstration on January 25th, 2011, when he was interviewed by Le Monde Diplomatique, said the workers had nothing to do with the revolution. They were very far from it. Wow. Khalid Khamisi, author of the best-selling novel Taxi, the strike wave of the last decade was intimately connected to the revolution. So there were, as I said earlier in the day, probably 4,000 strikes between 1998 and the end of 2010, maybe 2 to 4 million workers involved. Tunisia, not quite that scale, but there was a huge uprising in 2008 in the Gafsa phosphate basin, the same place where Mohamed Bouazizi immolated himself and set off the Tunisian uprising. So internal to the uprisings themselves is this struggle between those who would settle for an American-style democracy and high tech and that kind of subordinate development to the United States, and the demand for social justice, which can't possibly be satisfied under those conditions. So that's to say that this struggle in all of the countries where it has been raised, so less so in Libya, that wasn't quite what the uprising was about, less so in Yemen, less so in Syria, but certainly in Tunisia, in Morocco, in Egypt, and in Bahrain, this element is present, and in Jordan, element is present, that tension between what the liberals will settle for and what the larger sector of the people need to be able to survive at a decent level hasn't been resolved. And so I would say we haven't yet in any of these places had a revolution, even though in Tunisia, in Egypt, they are talking about the revolution. What has happened is the possibility of a revolution has opened up. So if we look at comparable or even other revolutionary situations between 1905 in Russia and 1917, was 12 years before the tension over how it was going to go was resolved. Whatever you think about was resolved, well, not well, whatever. In the United States, 1776 to 1789, when the Constitution was finally enacted, and you could even really stretch it to 1865 until slavery ended. So we don't even talk about gender in any of those situations yet. So a revolution is a process, and it can take a generation or more for it to develop and work itself out. So we need to be very patient and to have a long-term perspective. Now, it's also not a unidirectional process. So, for example, in Egypt, during the period from January 25th, the first demonstration, until February 11th, 2011, when Hosni Mubarak was ousted, there was beautiful unity between Muslims and Christians, wonderful gender relations. Women participated and fully and were protected, and nobody was harassing them, which, if you know something about what it's like for women to walk around the streets of Cairo, is a big change. People cleaned up after the demonstration, so the also completely revolutionary act in the context of Cairo. And then afterwards, you're having the army is doing virginity tests on women and dragging the woman with the blue bra that the picture went around the world, and incitement by the radical Islamists and the army against the cops and clashes. And it's not that this is all a dark plot. There are tensions between Muslims and Christians. They were overcome at a certain moment of euphoria, but it takes real work to carry that forward into really changing society. There was a big advance for gender relations in this period, but 18 days doesn't remake a patriarchal system that has been in place for generations and generations. So if we look then at workers, youth, women, people who have a stake in a big change in the country, they're not all united yet. Maybe they could be, maybe they won't be. They are still feeling around for how to come together. This is true in Tunisia, in Morocco, in Egypt, in Jordan, Bahrain a little bit less so. Bahrain, the opposition is rather united. It's the problem there is that the United States has given the Saudis all these arms with which to go in there and smash them. I mean, this is also because the Bahraini opposition has a very long history going back to the 1970s, where you have both communists and Arab nationalists who are fighting, and the current movement has its roots there. So that's also an important lesson, that what blew up in February, March 2011 in Bahrain goes all the way back to before Bahrain was even independent from the British to the 1970s. So things can take a long time. So I want to conclude then by emphasizing the importance of the long-term historical outlook. If we look back and see the failure of the Arab nationalist economic program, the failure of the global expansionary period, or the crisis of the global expansionary period of capitalism, the failure of the Arab New Left to take advantage of that moment for all sorts of complicated reasons, then this is the moment, as Deepa said, of the Muslim Brothers and the other Islamic forces. It's clear that they had an open way to step in, and they did it. So it's now going to take a certain amount of time for people to learn that they don't represent people's aspirations. Just as in Egypt it took the better part of the year for maybe 50% of Egyptians to understand that the army doesn't represent their aspirations, there are still lots of Egyptians who haven't been convinced of that yet. So we're going to be facing a contradictory and long-term process going forward whose outcome can't easily be predicted. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Benin. And last speaker, Wael El-Asadi.
Okay, thank you. I just want to start off, first off, by thanking all the speakers that came out today. Great presentations all around. I've learned more today than I have in a really long time. I also want to thank all the sponsors that helped make this conference happen, as well as all the people that volunteered their time and helped facilitate this. And real quick, I actually want all the students and Students United for Palestinian Equal Rights to just stand up real quick if they can. We're missing a few more.
There are secret members.
We've got a ghost committee somewhere. There are three or four members, but I just
and 200 secret members.
I just want to point out real quick that this conference was put together at the core by this small group of organizers. And I really want to encourage people students, community members, to actually join Students United for Palestinian Equal Rights and help us to continue to build conferences such as this one. We're in with the Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions Coalition. We are doing a campaign to pressure New Seasons to stop carrying Israeli products. So one thing that I want everybody to do before they leave, if they can today, is In that room, there is a where the Haymarket books are. There is a table with a letter that we're sending to New Seasons, asking them to stop carrying Israeli products until they dismantle their system of apartheid and end the oppression of the Palestinian people. And we have a project where we want to take up the occupations, the wars, the Islamophobia that the U.S. government is perpetuating both abroad, but also that they're perpetuating here. And, of course, what we see at the center of that, as Asad Abu Khalil mentioned, the Israeli occupation, which actually takes a lot of those things and is central to both the U.S. ability to control the region. So that is our project. And again, I want to encourage people to help us participate in that. And I want to just talk about a couple things before we end the conference. As a lot of the panelists here today have mentioned, the people in the Arab world and in North Africa are facing several enemies. One of the enemies, obviously, are the national ruling classes that are bent on carrying out a counter-revolution against their people, stopping these popular uprisings in their tracks and turning back the tide. But there is another force. They face two forces on the battlefield, and that is the force of the United States government, which is funding, which is giving political support, and which is giving economic as well as military support to these counter-revolutionary measures to stop these revolutions in their tracks. Because they know that if the aspirations of the people of the Middle East are actually met, there is absolutely no way that they will move forward with the political and economic agenda of the United States and its dictatorship allies and Israel in the region. And I think that's where we see a large part for us here, where we actually have to take the lessons that the Middle East, that the Arab Spring have taught us in terms of tactics, in terms of their ability to challenge their rulers and bring them here and actually build a movement in this country that can challenge the U.S. government until they bring home every single weapon, until they bring home every single military base, until they bring home every single dollar and every single soldier back to this country. And I want to be clear, because I don't think this solidarity is one way. It's not just a matter of actually ending the oppression of the people of the Middle East. It is completely tied into the oppression that we face here in this country. It's not a coincidence that the drones that are bombing Pakistan, that are bombing Yemen, the tear gas canisters that are being used to attack protesters anywhere from the West Bank to Egypt are made and produced in the United States. And those exact same weapons we look at, you know, one thing that was in the media that was absolutely crazy is the level of sale by the military in this government to local, just giving local police forces drones and actually militarizing the police force for the repression of our own protest movements here. There was a coordinated attack used on the Occupy movement for simply protesting in parks. And it's along with this military hardware, it is the laws that have been passed. And they have been passed because of the Islamophobic and racist ideology that has allowed the fear of Muslims to be able to pass laws like the National Defense Authorization Act, and other laws that are actually being used to attack us here. There has been a huge huge increase in the budget of the Homeland Security Department. Obviously, a large part of it has been used to attack the Muslim community, the Arab community here. But a very significant portion of that has actually gone, like I said, to militarize the police forces, which are attacking our Latino immigrant populations, as well as laws that are being used to continue to attack the historically oppressed black population in this country. So what is happening in the Middle East right now And our solidarity with the people of the Arab world are absolutely connected to our ability here to fight for our own freedoms. And I think one of the things that we have to do is we've talked about the lack of, to a certain extent, these massive uprisings that have occurred, and the political weakness and organization of the political left in the Arab world to be able to help lead with these help lead the revolutions. We have a similar weakness here, and we are in a situation where our own struggles have just begun. The international economic crisis is not going anywhere anytime soon, and the U.S. ruling class has a plan to take that out on the workers of this country as well. And I think we have to actually organize ourselves, rebuild the left in this country to both be able to end the wars and the counter-revolutionary measures that the U.S. is taking in the Arab world, as well as challenge our own government here.
Thank you very much for the speakers. I don't think we have a time for the question and answer session, but we have a cultural night and dinner celebration, room 228, 8 to 10 p.m. 8 to 10 p.m.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.